From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, cages, literal and metaphorical.
And a lot of people, they draw a bunch of criminal things in the 8th circle, and then you see why I led them there.
Latinos are the fastest growing minority group in jails and prisons. We visit teens on Rikers Island and hear about their dreams and their education. And then,
I am trapped inside a body that it's unable to move or respond. And it happened so suddenly with no warning whatsoever.
One of the country's leading performance artists talks about being trapped in his own body, prison baño art, living isolated in Cuba, and so much more when we talk cages on this hour of Latino USA. Stay with us. No se vayan. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about cages. The sad reality is that in the U.S., more people are imprisoned than in any other place in the world. Over 1.5 million people behind bars. We're rarely reminded of this statistic unless it's in pop culture.
My name is Piper Chapman. I carried a suitcase of drug money once, 10 years ago.
And even then, it takes a white protagonist to bring attention to a justice system that disproportionately affects people of color. There are nearly 350,000 Latino men and women in state and federal prisons, and far more of those are younger than white prisoners. In fact, and listen closely to this statistic, over twice as many Latinos live in jails or prisons than in college dorms. There are few cages larger than Rikers Island. It's the largest jail in the world, a 413-acre island sitting right in the middle of the East River in New York City. There's only one way on or off, across a bridge with security checkpoints at both ends. In this special report, we look at a new program here that's trying to keep young inmates off the island and out of jail for good.
Okay.
On any given day, Rikers Island has somewhere around 15,000 inmates, most of whom are still awaiting trial. That's almost the same number of inmates as the entire Connecticut prison system.
So we've just made it through a series of gates, but where we are right now is in a room that is chock full of actually riot gear, and now we're in an elevator.
Rikers is an adult correctional facility. But because New York State criminal courts automatically treat 16-year-olds as adults, Rikers has a small group of inmates who are still legally minors, about 5%. Federal law says these young inmates, age 16 to 18, must be physically removed from the adult population. It's also mandatory that they attend high school. As we get off the elevator, there's an eye-catching poster that says East River Academy.
And they have quotes from Victor Hugo that says, "He who opens a school door closes a prison."
In some ways, the East River Academy on Rikers looks like any other high school. The students take classes, study for tests. You can see A-plus work tacked up to the boards in the hallways.
How would you make this an algebra problem? That's what I want to hear you say.
But East River Academy has something you won't find anywhere else. A new school program designed to lower juvenile recidivism. That is, to keep young inmates from coming back here. It's called ABLE, which stands for Adolescent Behavioral Learning Experience. ABLE uses something called Moral Reconation Therapy, or MRT.
Reconation. It's a made-up word.
What's your name?
Roxy Pimentel.
Pimentel?
Yeah, and I've been here working now as a facilitator for about a year now, actually.
Okay. A moral reconation therapy.
Yes.
Oh, okay, what does it mean?
Basically, it's a way to restructure your morals.
We're in a nondescript classroom. There are gates on the windows, and officers roam the hallways. A group of about 15 young men wearing brown jumpsuits quietly walk in and take their seats.
Guys, just listen up.
Roxy starts explaining what moral reincarnation therapy is all about.
Okay. This is a book. It's a book, and it doesn't become significant to you unless you give it meaning.
This book, How to Escape Your Prison, doesn't just address the outer, physical cage that these kids are in. It also focuses on the inner, mental cage, the behavior and choices that got them here. The book is divided into 12 steps, starting with admitting disloyalty to yourself, to your family, to your friends. Then it takes the kids through evaluating their relationships, facing danger, and eliminating bad habits.
My name is Jared, and I'm 18 years old.
How long have you been in Rikers?
6.5 months, going on 7.
Do you know when you're going to get out?
Hopefully sometime soon.
Jared is tall and dark-skinned. There is a sadness about him, but there's also a liveliness in his eyes. He tells me about how one exercise in the MRT course helped him.
It's like a stepper tells you, in a circle to draw all the things you like to do. And then you got to sit there and think about those 8 things. And the 8 things, you have to say why, like how, in a way, how it led you to being in here. And a lot of people, they draw a bunch of criminal things in the 8 circle. And then you see why it led them there, the things they like to do. So they know that they got to change that when they go out.
It's a tall order to ask any teenager to be so introspective and self-critical. It's an even taller order for the kids who are sent here. East River Academy may be a school, but no one forgets that it's still in a jail.
Just one question. How many of you are Latino in this class? Raise your hand.
I'm Dominican.
Trinitario, Dominicano, ¿oíste?
Trinitario, as in the Dominican gang created inside the New York State prison system back in 1989.
MRT class, you ain't no suck. Don't trust no one, man. Sit. Off this.
Not every kid chooses to buy into the program. Not surprisingly, many don't trust it at all. But Jared, who told us about the drawing exercise, is starting to. He tells me that MRT helped him understand his own situation better.
I don't think I'd have learned half the stuff about myself that I learned now just going through some of the steps. One of them is I have a smart mouth. And another one is, like, I like to talk a lot. So I didn't really notice it until I wrote it down, and then MRT teacher, he agreed.
He says he's come a long way. In fact,
do you have your high school diploma now?
Yes.
And you graduated from inside Rikers?
Yes.
Did you ever imagine that you'd be saying that you got your high school degree inside Rikers?
Not at all.
Congratulations to all the MRT graduates.
Every few months, there's a graduation ceremony for students who successfully complete the MRT course. Kids get the chance to visit with family members and eat food from the town, which is what they call the outside world, a world they're one step closer to being part of again. I meet one graduate who tells me what it takes to complete the MRT course.
My name is Noel. I've been here for 2 months and like 3 days.
Noel is Puerto Rican from Queens.
I actually started MRT September 3rd, and I finished it October 3rd. Unlike other people, I took 9 months or maybe longer for the simple fact that I didn't waste time because I didn't let anybody, like, get in my way of doing what I have to do. Feel me?
An achievement like this can be the silver lining for a teenager who ends up at Rikers, says Dora Schriero,
Commissioner, New York City Department of Correction. I wouldn't recommend that anyone use this as their strategy to get a diploma, but jail can create an environment in which people can focus on themselves to being good young adults when they get back to the street.
The whole thing is an experiment, not just for the kids, but in the very way the program is set up. ABLE is funded through a social impact bond from Goldman Sachs, on the gamble that it will lower recidivism and save the Department of Corrections enough money to pay back their investors. It will be years before anyone knows if that investment will pay off, but it's already turned around one life.
A lot of kids in here don't listen. But then, if you're the standout kid...
That's Jared.
You know you made a mistake. You could go home and still fix your life. You're gonna do so. Nobody wants to be in jail the rest of their life.
And now, the story of another inmate, a former inmate named Juan Echeverria. During his 15 years inside several prisons, he took classes and even started an HIV education program. But once Juan got out, finding work was hard, until he got a job helping men and women facing the same struggles as him. He came to our studio to tell us what we don't know about former inmates.
My name is Juan Echeverria, and I am a contract coach for Exodus Transitional Community. When brothers and sisters come home from prison, I meet with them to assist them with meeting needs for housing, for employment, for mental health, substance abuse. It feels good to be able to help the next person get to that next place, you know, especially when a person is homeless, and being able to connect them dots for them and get them someplace is a good feeling. The abilities of ex-offenders and the skills, the intellect of many ex-offenders, pretty outstanding. What a lot of people don't know is that ex-offenders can be as ethical in a workplace as anyone else. And employment with ex-offenders is the number one priority. So when they're overlooked, even though they have pages of skills, it's very hard on them to have to take a dishwashing job. And what happens is that right there is what reverts back to more criminality. It's like you would need at least 3 incomes to be able to live. I have come across people who are actually nurses and they cannot get back. Trying to get back, so now they have to go and do babysitting. So that is very hard on a lot of ex-offenders. And one thing that I've noticed that ex-offenders are not noticing is that everybody is going through the same struggles. You know, not just ex-offenders, not just minorities, but I'm speaking about like even middle-class white women. They're having to live with 2 or 3 roommates just to get by. But from appearance, when you see them, you would think they're well off. So when I've noticed that, is now I got the message to come back to the ex-offenders that, listen, hold on, wait a minute. It's not just you. So if everyone else is going through it, that means you have to work that much harder to make sure that you can come out of that. You know, and that's one thing they don't notice, because they get the me against the world type attitude and they feel like they're targeted. Then now they put more effort. Because it's like, okay, it's not just against me, it's everyone else that's going through the same things. I can do it too.
Juan Echeverria works at the Exodus Transitional Community in New York City. Coming up on Latino USA.
Pass the word. It's reporting a checkpoint of licenses on 421 near Walmart in Siler City, and it's 3:22 p.m.
Using social media to combat police tactics targeting immigrants. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Para venderte medicina y no se endrogan, no se embrutecen. Cualquier pregunta que tengamos la adormecen. Son las mentiras recalentadas, nos alimentan con carne procesada y la gente sigue desinformada. Una noticia mal contada es un asalto a mano armada. Nos infiltramos, nos duplicamos como las células, nos multiplicamos. Al que no quiere caldo se le dan 2 tazas. Somos la levadura que levanta la masa. Nuestras ideas son libres y están despiertas, porque pensamos con las puertas abiertas. Lo que no se ve lo estamos viendo. Nacimos sin saber hablar, pero vamos a morir diciendo.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now to another place where education is blossoming behind jail walls. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Gordon Burnell Charter School is helping adults reclaim their lives and plan for life once they're on the outside. Megan Kemrick has this story.
The Metropolitan Detention Center is less than half an hour from downtown Albuquerque, but it feels worlds away. The only other traffic on the two-lane road here are trucks hauling trash to a landfill. Inside, inmates in orange jumpsuits march single file, hands clasped behind backs. Their crimes range from misdemeanors to murder. Nearly half of them are Latino. Another 11% are Native American. Some will be here for a few months. For others, this is a way stop before years in prison. But this county jail isn't a dead end for everyone.
Sometimes I find myself forgetting that I'm in jail. Being there doing schoolwork, you feel like you're out there actually still in the world getting ahead, you know what I mean?
Ezekiel Rennick has been here for 6 months. He's working toward his high school diploma here at the Gordon Burnell Charter School. Ezekiel dropped out as a teenager, but here he found a better fit.
And here it's like the teachers take time to teach you. You're working at your own pace. You're not forced to do it so much under pressure under a certain time, so you actually absorb it.
One of Ezekiel's teachers is Denise Young. She almost left education out of frustration until she found this job. Here, she can actually build relationships with students.
I know them. I mean, when I taught middle school, it's like I barely knew if a kid was a proficient reader or not. And these guys, almost any one of them, I can tell you what their skill level is, some of what their interests are. I'm able to tailor almost a canned curriculum into something that really works for them.
Ezekiel has struggled with addiction, a common problem for men entering the jail. For women, the biggest issue is trauma. So besides English and math, the students take mandatory life skills classes, and these are woven into core subjects. They learn conflict resolution in language arts and the components of addiction in biology. In math class, they discover the economic benefits of staying in school. Some students can't even write their names when they come in, but most read between a fourth and sixth grade level. There's a definite correlation between illiteracy and family problems and incarceration. Here's Gordon Burnell principal, Kimberly Hansen.
So there wasn't the home support, and then that's when the behavior issues and the truancy start, and then they just fall away and you lose them.
That's what happened to Monique Vargas. She dropped out of school in 11th grade, but now she dreams of studying engineering and building rockets.
I had a real tough life growing up. I didn't have my parents, so I've had to kind of raise myself. I've been here multiple times. Not proud of it, but I do pray and hope that this is my last time and I don't want to come back.
It's not uncommon to see students who do come back. Some might not have been ready for life on the outside. Maybe the decision to change didn't take root. But the teachers help students build on each success. At one recent ceremony, Monique gets several certificates for earning credits towards her diploma.
Monique Vargas, half credit in private.
When inmates are released from the jail, they take a bus that unloads them right in downtown Albuquerque. It's near Gordon Burnell's downtown campus, where other adults study too. The idea is to cushion the inmates' transition to life outside the jail and also make sure they complete their studies. Teacher and poet Carlos Contreras says the school reignites a sense of self-worth for people who have been tossed aside by society.
You know, I think that after so many years of so many closed doors or so many no's or so many negative results in their life, it can be really hard to be positive. I continually see this school be a sense of positivity and pride for folks. It's just a safe place.
The results aren't perfect. The recidivism rate for last year's graduates was about 15%, but for the jail as a whole, it was 25%. And lower recidivism saves taxpayers money. By conventional standards, like test scores and class attendance, the school has been ranked low by the state of New Mexico. But downtown campus principal Dan Bussey says that's not the whole picture.
The fact that for our students to come to a class,
sit in a chair or take work home and then come back with something completed, this may in fact be the first time in their lives where they've completed anything.
And that can set them on the road to becoming well-rounded human beings, as well as achieving academic success, rewriting their stories. For Latino USA, I'm Megan Kamrick in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
We at Latino USA are very proud to bring you an entire show about incarceration. But we didn't want our show to be a total downer because living behind bars can push you to be creative. Many Latino prisoners have been using square pieces of cotton called paños from pañuelos or handkerchiefs to create elaborate scenes with a ballpoint pen. It's a form of art that began in the 1950s, and some curators now recognize the paños as folk art.
So we're in a cramped hallway in an apartment on the 14th floor on the Upper East Side of New York City, and everything in the hallway is all paño art.
Floor to ceiling.
That's Martha Henry, who curated a collection of paño art. Most were made in the 1990s by prisoners in San Antonio, Texas, when she says the art form blossomed. The collection has toured all over the world.
The black and white ones are intended for fellow inmates or fellow gang members. So when you see the ones in color, good chances are that the prisoners were able to be in kind of an art program and they were given materials so that they had access to color.
We zoom in on one 8x8-inch handkerchief in a glass frame.
He's showing his crime. He's showing his temptations, women. You've got the key. He's incarcerated. He's trying to take the key back. The fact that this is a lamp, a magic lantern, means that this type of paño is called a viaje, which means a trip.
The sources of inspiration for paño art are Chicano pride, gang life, lost relationships, love, and boredom.
That's the big challenge of being in prison, is finding the way to pass the time. You know, a lot of prisons don't allow this. This is illegal stuff. And so if a warden came in and saw that, then it would be seized from him. He would be punished. He'd go into lockdown for having made this. And that's one of the reasons why the medium, the canvas, is so great, because it's just, they just fold it up, put it in a pocket, and these, they can be mailed out in envelopes and get them out of the prison.
The apartment we're in belongs to curator David Jora Lemon, who says the paños fit naturally with his collection of Latin American art.
We've had all sorts of people look at them and read them in different ways. Some people are profoundly sad about them because they see the kind of talent and creativity that the paños represent, but then they understand that they're coming from, you know, people who are in very extreme positions and people who may have done terrible things.
So while some people might look at the paños and feel sad, when you look at them, what do you see?
I see the creativity of them, the skill in making the drawings in, you know, difficult circumstances. So I tend to see them as isolated art of people who have an issue about borders, about one foot in Mexico, one foot here, and they're in many cases sort of playing those identity issues out in their drawings.
Some of the artists sign their names. Most remain nameless. But here on the outside, the paños serve as a reminder that these prisoners and their artistic voice exist. To see a sample of the collection and to find out why paño art became illegal in Texas prisons, go to our website, latinousa.org. It's not just the law that can keep people imprisoned. Kidnappings in Mexico have soared in recent years. Most abductions are never reported to authorities because Mexican families fear reprisal. Even in my own family in Mexico, it's happened, but it's rarely talked about. Jose Garcia, though, wants to tell his kidnapping story. Jose is a U.S. citizen from Hood River, Oregon, but his wife was denied a green card in 2009 and barred from living in the U.S. So Jose visits her and their children in Mexico twice a year. After landing in Guadalajara earlier this year, Jose says his visit took a harrowing turn. We were unable to independently verify Garcia's story, but his relatives and attorney confirm his account. Here's Jose Garcia's kidnapping in his own words.
I was driving in the highway, and then I noticed that I was being followed by a pickup with people in it that were armed. So I got out of the road, but then they stopped too along with me. Then they approached me at gunpoint, saying to get out of the car, that not to ask questions. And then they took me in the back of the pickup. They covered me with a blanket. I calculate we drove like for 2 hours, and then we got to the place. They pulled me out of the pickup. Their faces were all covered up, so I didn't know who they were. They all of them were carrying long rifles. I was handcuffed, and then my face got covered with something. I think 2 hours later, they brought me a cell phone. They just asked, call one of your relatives and tell them that we want 2 million pesos. If not, then we're gonna kill you. I was blindfolded most of the time. I was just in dark the whole time. I would be just thinking of my life, of my kids. I was just hoping the best, but at the same time, I was expecting the worst. I didn't sleep at all because I was afraid if I'd sleep, they would kill me while I was asleep. At first, they treat me, they beat me up lightly just to show that they had power. They would beat the other people really severely. They wouldn't do that to me a lot because the reason I was there, it was for money. So I think they had to treat me somehow okay. I don't know. The people that were there were for other reasons. I don't know. But they would treat them really bad. They would almost kill them alive. So I would hear and listen to that every day. And I would hear all the pain that they were going through. One of those man was killed and decapitated and cut in pieces. Yeah. I didn't see it directly, but I could hear it, the conversations that they were having, how they were killing him in pieces. So first they shoot him just to make him suffer, and then he got decapitated, yeah, because I was listening to everything. And then later I could hear that they were cutting him in pieces. Piece by piece. One time I called my wife that they let me, and my daughter was there, and she asked me where I was because she was waiting for me. She knew that I was coming. I told her that I was working. That was I think more traumatic for me than listening to the guy getting killed. My daughter asking me where I was, and I couldn't tell her what was going on or where I was. One day, one of the guys that were taking care of me said, let's go to the hotel nearby. You're going to take a shower. Then after that, they took me to this shopping center in the parking lot. One of my uncles was there already because they had told him that I was going to be dropped there. So then from there, I was released. I think the toughest weeks, months have been after my release, not those 3 weeks. I get anxiety. I get anxious because I want to get over it, but I can't yet. That's what I'm saying. It's still stressful for me. I'm still paying for my life.
That's Jose Garcia, a U.S. citizen from Hood River, Oregon. Garcia's relatives say they raised 1.5 million pesos, over $113,000, to free him. He told his story to Oregon Public Broadcasting's Jordana Gustafson. And now to Siler City, North Carolina, which is a working-class town of farms and factories. About half of the town is Latino now. Police put up checkpoints about twice a week in Siler City. They say these traffic stops keep drunk driving and other problems down, but to the town's Latinos, the checkpoints can be intimidating. So, two young men have decided to check the checkpoints in their own way, via Facebook.
Okay, so my name is Gilly Contreras.
And my name is Oswaldo Contreras.
This is a Facebook page for Solar City Checkpoints. And the way we get the information is either someone sends it to us or someone texts it to me personally and I update the page.
With Solar City Checkpoints, it makes it a lot harder for them to sort of catch us off guard, because Facebook starts rolling the ball and everyone finds out.
This is not supposed to be anti-police. It's anti-checkpoints. So we wanted it to be the idea that we're watching out for our own community.
My name is Gary Tyson, Chief of Police, Silas City, North Carolina. Every police department do checkpoints. This is my 26th year in law enforcement, and I've been doing checkpoints since I started. So this is nothing unique to Silas City, checkpoints.
It says, pasa la voz, se reporta un chequeo de licencia en 421 por Walmart in Siler City, 322 p.m., Mayo of 2013. So it says, pass the word. It's reporting a checkpoint of licenses on 421 near Walmart in Siler City, and it's 322 p.m.
My door is open to the Latino population here, whether they were documented or undocumented. And I took a hit from a lot of chief of police's around the state, because I took a stand. I said that I am not an immigration agent. I'm a chief of police that tried to build a trust equity up within the community.
But I remember one time in high school, I was talking to some of my friends, and they're like, yeah, you know, the checkpoints. And my friend happens to be white, and he lives in the area where it's mostly, you know, white people in Siler City. And he's like, what checkpoints? I've never been through one. And I'm like, I only had my license for a year, and I've already been through like a dozen. And I'm like, what? They don't happen anywhere else in Siler City, only where the Hispanics lives?
I did sense there could potentially be a problem a couple years ago. And so I went to what I thought was a better way to make sure that we was, you know, covering the whole city, that we did not just pick a certain couple of streets.
We're in the South. You have to drive everywhere. So it's just kind of informally making like a boundary for our communities.
I felt like the times of day was important. I felt like that people should be able to go to work unabated. Checkpoints on Sunday morning was an issue. I feel like people that's trying to go to church should be able to go to church unabated with checkpoints. So there was just common sense things. And we got 11 checkpoints. Any checkpoint we go through, we're going to have Latino, because they have half our population. And we don't have the Latino population just in one part of the community. They are all over our community, and we're proud of them.
I think it's time for them to change a little, you know, be a little bit more open-minded, be more understanding that this community isn't going to change. Since 1998, it's been growing in Latinos, and it's not going to go anytime soon. So it's time to adapt to it and be okay with what they see in the town.
I want to better the relationship with the community, and I think we have. I think if you ask some people to live here, the police and the Hispanic community have really made gains. I really believe that.
Osvaldo and Gilly Contreras and Siler City Police Chief Gary Tyson. So, do your local police set up checkpoints? Do you feel like they're effective law enforcement or just another kind of police harassment? Find us on Facebook or tweet us at Latino USA and tell us your story. Coming up on Latino USA.
I can't move. I have no sensation whatsoever in my arms and legs.
Performance artist Guillermo Gomez Peña on being trapped in his own body. No se vayan.
Aprendí que
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, we're talking about being or feeling caged in. Guillermo Gomez Peña is one of the country's leading performance artists and director of the performance art troupe La Pocha Nostra. Last year, he contracted a rare disease that paralyzed him and turned him into a prisoner of his own body.
November 21st, 2012, Mexico City. I have been on the road with my troupe, La Pocha Nostra, for more than 6 months straight. It's been exhausting, to say the least. The theme we've been working with for the performance is the different body, the frail and eccentric body. And now, in some kind of bizarre, retro-prophetic seeming twist of fate, I am being diagnosed with a viral infection of my spinal cord. I am flat on my back, confused and in pain, as the doctor tells me the Latin name of this disease I have never heard of, mielitis traversa. And from the look on his face, I can tell this is very, very bad news. I can't move. I have no sensation whatsoever in my arms and legs, and I can't speak clearly because my mouth and tongue don't seem to be working either. I am trapped inside a body that is unable to move or respond, and it happened so suddenly with no warning whatsoever. As if this weren't enough, my immune system has shut down completely, which means that I can't be brought to a hospital, since leaving my room could expose me to something that might kill me. In addition to the daily cocktail of medicines, I am given 9 different pills and an injection each day. I am told that my treatment will involve having to adjust to the exact opposite of my habitual lifestyle, a new regime of limited mobility, rigid dietary restrictions, no spicy or heavy foods, and no sweets whatsoever, no drinking or smoking, and almost complete social isolation. As a nomadic performance artist, an intensity seeker, and a 7-day-a-week bohemian, how do I engage in an extreme exercise of willpower and adapt for an undetermined span of time to a life of silence, isolation, forced rest, and Spartan dietary discipline? I can't exercise. I can't rehearse. I can't perform. I can't even write. Every day, after a few hours of sleep, I wake up around 5 a.m. to face a long day ahead of clumsiness, emptiness, and fear. As December progresses, I begin to slowly recapture my mobility. First, I can move my toes, then my hands and arms, my torso, and finally, my legs. It takes me a while to walk to the bathroom. Meanwhile, my wristwatch has stopped working. The computer is my only certainty. The tiny clock on its upper right corner gives me a sense of time, and so do the daily headlines and photographs in La Jornada online. My primary relationship to the world is through the internet. When the doctor finally gives me permission to go to a neighborhood restaurant, before or after hours only, I am beside myself. Word begins to spread, and some of my childhood friends start showing up to find out what's happening to super skinny Guillermo. I am even happier when the doctor allows me to begin having more friends over during the evenings, 2 or 3 at once. That is, as long as they aren't ill. A flu could still be a grave threat for me, turning overnight into TB or chronic bronchitis. I realize it is always an entire community that heals each individual. That's something I would have deleted as too sentimental or cliché in my previous life. But the thing is, back then, I didn't know anything about this. It's December 31st, 2012, noon. Dr. Alberto shows up with the good news. My new test results indicate that my immune system is 40% back, and both the myelitis and the parasites are decreasing considerably. The doctor invites us to toast to the new year and even suggests that I can have a drink, a light one. My brother Carlos brings out a bottle of tequila Patron and a plate full of romeritos con mole and shrimp tortitas. I am ecstatic. It's mid-January and I'm back in my loft in San Francisco. The only side effects left from my myelitis traversa are the occasional muscle spasms at night, the fact that I am constantly biting my tongue when I chew, and, oh, I forgot, the weird games my memory still plays on me when I least expect it. According to the doctor, if everything works out, I will be able to perform and teach again sometime in late February or March. It will be a different pace and daily schedule, true, but the amazing fact is that I might be back on the road very soon.
Guillermo, you have been on the road now for over a month. What is it like now to kind of settle back after doing these performances, reaching all of these audiences, and then coming back home to, you know, to the Bay Area?
Well, it's a pleasure for me to be back on the road. It took me practically 1 year to go from the back seat in the bus of my troupe, quietly observing the process, to slowly becoming more involved, regaining my body, regaining my intellectual abilities, and now driving again the bus, so to speak. This last tour was particularly important. Era como una prueba de fuego, no? It was necessary for me to prove that I was able to be back in the kind of life that I love and treasure that has been, you know, my life, being a nomadic provocateur, a professional iconoclast on the road. And I was able to do it.
And so now that you've proved to yourself that you were able to do it, what have you learned on a personal level? I mean, now that you've been on tour, that you've been able to, your health has withstood it, what's the lesson that you're sitting with about your own life and life as an artist in this moment in history?
I've been so conscious of my own mortality, so conscious of the frailty of my body and mind, has made me much more humble, much more appreciative of my friends, my relatives, my art. Also has made me aware even more of the importance of mentoring young artists. And that is something that became quite clear when I realized that I might have lost my life.
But you didn't, and we're so happy that you're still here, Guillermo Gomez Peña. Thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
It's an absolute pleasure to be back on Latino USA.
It's great to have you back, Guillermo, and that wonderful voice. So from the airwaves, un super fuerte abrazo para ti. Guillermo Gomez Peña is the director of the performance art troupe La Pocha Nostra. For a link to see more of Guillermo's art, visit our website, latinousa.org. So, in our hyper-connected world, not having access to the internet for some people can make you feel caged in. In Cuba, one of the least connected countries in the world, simple internet access can be difficult at best. And those who use the internet to criticize the government are often harassed or jailed. Orlando Luis Pardo Lasso is a Cuban blogger, dissident, and the founder of Cuba's first digital magazine called Voces. He joins us in our studio in Harlem. So welcome to Latino USA, Orlando.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
So give us a sense of what it is to become a blogger in Cuba, one of the last countries to open itself up
to the internet.
Yes, it's a complete impossibility. We are working in an absurd environment because the Cuban state, the Cuban telephone company, Etexa, is not giving service of internet, domestic service, to Cubans. You need to be a foreigner, permanently residing in Cuba, or you need to work or study in some specific privileged institutions. Although there is a huge black market of internet in Cuba, and we are taking advantage of that.
So when you talk about a black market for the internet, what does that look like?
It means the very webmasters from state companies, from universities, from the privileged state-run institutions that have internet are selling after hours during the night. They are selling the internet accounts, login and password to the regular people. We have also, especially in Havana City, the tourist hotels where you can pay, it's very expensive, up to $10 one hour of Wi-Fi internet. And last month, the Cuban state opened in Havana City again around 100 cyber cafe. We have discovered the cyber cafe 20 years after the cyber cafe in the world. And it will be $5 the hour. It's still very expensive in a country where the average salary will be around $15 a month.
So you knew, you know, that your mission was to be a writer. But at the same time, what's happened to you is that the more you've become a blogger, it's actually meant that the government has kind of come down on you as the writer that you always were.
Yes, my book, Boring Home, that was supposed to be presented in Havana Book Fair. And I was told that I must close my blog or I would never publish again in Cuba. And at that point, it was too late for me. I loved my blog. I didn't want to close it. So I took the challenge and I decided to work outside all institutions. And somehow I ended up being like a social activist.
So what has the internet meant to civil society and to the possibilities of democratizing Cuba? Or has the internet become a place where now the government is even clamping down even further?
To begin with, in my opinion, there will be no Havana Spring in terms of civil society in internet. We don't have internet in our mobile phones. And I want to put you a sad example. When the Pope, the former Pope Benedict XVI, visited Havana on March 2012, hundreds of activists, including myself, were arrested preventively. Our mobile were shut down and we remained almost a week on police stations without charges, without the possibility of making a phone call, only to avoid the presence of a critical mass of independent actors in the streets. So they have learned, the Cuban state has learned carefully the experience of Arab Spring.
Do you feel freer here?
No, there. I was very, very free in Cuba. The moment I decided not to remain silent but express myself in a blog, I was like in a strange kind of peace. And I said, okay, now they can come for me. They can arrest me. They can do whatever they want because I have recovered my natural channel of expression. My soul has a way to be known by the world and the world can know who I was, who was Orlando Luis Pardo Lasso in this time. No? Indeed, in my blog in the United States, I have been publishing very, very few, some columns about New York that I love Manhattan, but I had the feeling that only Havana talks to me and then I talk back to Havana. And this is not happening in any other city so far.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your thoughts. We really appreciate it. And good luck to you, Orlando.
No, thank you for this possibility.
Orlando Luis Pardo Lasso is the editor of Cuba's first digital magazine called Voces. And finally, for this week's sabiduría, or wisdom, to send you off for the week, we hear once again from retired Army Lieutenant Consuelo Castillo Kickbush, an author and an educator. She shares one of her favorite stories about her parents from before she was born. The family found themselves in Illinois so her dad could take a job. But there, they settled into a different kind of cage.
So my parents arrived in Sterling, Illinois with four boys. Well, my father got a job. And there was
no one that would rent them a place to live. So the company, having hired all these, what may have been seasonal workers at the time, took these boxcars, derailed them, and basically, if you can imagine, put them on a cornfield as they were. It's a steel box. And over 100 and some families began their lives there up north. It's known as the boxcar settlement. The story is that my mother goes inside and she begins to convert it into a home. And she tells my father, as he goes up to the steel mill, I need you to come back with a solution for me to put up curtains. And my father, you know, looks at my mother and he looks at the steel one. He says, what is it that she sees? Because there are no windows. So he goes into the steel mill, the story is, and he tells his friends, you know, the la vieja, you know, that's darling in English for those that, he says, she wants to put up curtains. And they all looked at this, you know, puzzled and said, there are no windows. He said, I know, but do you want to go tell her? And I think that Latina women, you know, once they set their mind, they go for it. Later that night, my father, you know, let his curiosity get the best of him. And he says to my mother, you know, vieja, why do you want these curtains when there are no windows? And I'm trying to visualize and getting up and saying to my father, today I don't have windows for my children to look beyond, but I will have curtains for them to ask me, what is behind these curtains? Today there's a steel wall. I want my children to have a vision, and it starts with how they see life. And I see life for my children far beyond these steel walls.
Words of wisdom, sabiduría, from Consuelo Castillo Kickbush. And that is it for this week of Latino USA. Our episode was produced this week by AC Valdez, Carolina Gonzalez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, Camilo Vargas, Antonia Cerejido, and Michael Jones. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Additional engineering by Brendan Baker. Julia Alsop is our intern, and this week we say a fond farewell and a muchas gracias to our interns Sarah Barrett and Roxanne Scott. This is not goodbye, mujeres. It's just see you later. Thank you so much for all of the ideas and contributions you brought to the Latino USA newsroom, where you have a home. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, we'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Okay.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.